are friends with fantasy benefits.
Mike, how hard are you right now?
Oh, man, I've been hard since you said, hi, welcome to Friends with Fantasy Benefits podcast.
I like to imagine you're sort of sat at home in like a glittery game show host coat for this one, but I'm guessing that's probably not the case.
We are friends with fantasy benefits.
But as a guy who's going really, 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 if he's going at all late.
We are friends with fantasy benefits.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a Friends with Fantasy Benefits pop quiz podcast. This is our new format for Wednesdays, if you have not heard it before. I send out a player list, usually to a couple of blokes, and the analysts try to figure out why I put these people together. The first week I was pretty easy, and it was pretty apparent. I think this week will be a little trickier. And we ended up with just one analyst today, and that analyst, though, is the venerable Darius Austin. How are you, Darius, across the pond?
Yeah, I'm doing very well. Thank you, Chuck. I like to imagine you're sort of sat at home in like a glittery game show host coat for this one, but I'm guessing that's probably not the case.
Yeah, that's not exactly the case, but at least since you sent an image across to everyone, at least everyone can know that I'm fully clothed. I'm just in summer gear because it's starting to pretend like it's spring here in Wisconsin. So anyway, I am Chuck Anderson. I can be reached on Twitter at Just Chucking It. I am the person who made the false accusation yesterday that Alex Cobb was going to end up being a free agent until June. And then when the draft compensation came off, that's when he was going to sign. So, of course, that night he signed. Darius, what's your Twitter handle and what's your take on the Alex Cobb signing?
You can find me on Twitter at DariusA64. The Alex Cobb signing seems extremely Baltimore to me. I don't really know what they're doing, but then I never really know what they're doing. I guess that's nothing new in that regard. But I guess I also feel like Lance Lynn probably feels a little bit slighted by this. But maybe he didn't just want to go to Baltimore. So, yeah, I don't really like the move. It's not a great park to pitch in. I'm not that high on Cobb anyway. So the fact that he's ended up in Baltimore doesn't really make me inclined to go out and draft him. But I guess at least he has a job, which is more than like Greg Holland can say right now.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, my take originally was that I figured Greg Holland was going to sign somewhere because who couldn't use a top-flight reliever? But now we have this, and while we do know that the Orioles offered a multi-year deal to Lance Lynn, I think they would have been better off throwing $60 million at Lance Lynn than throwing $60 million at Alex Cobb. But like you summarized it greatly, it is very Baltimore. I think sometimes members of the media are afraid to be too harsh when things are done by a certain management team or certain members of professional sports. Well, I do not consider myself to be a member of the media, and I do not mind telling you that I think Peter Angelos is the worst owner in the history of professional sports. And I really don't care if someone tells him that personally. That team was, I'm old enough to remember that team was the pride and joy of that city and was a perennial contender. And him and his overseeing of moves and the purse strings has driven that team right into the ground. So regardless of all that, he was not on our player list today. But someone, oddly enough, who was on our player list today was Matt Kemp, and he's a guy that we have not spoken about, and many of you out there can figure out numerous reasons. He's sort of turned into an expensive piece of driftwood the last couple of off seasons. He went to Atlanta, which I do think Atlanta, you know, had a regular spot for him and hoped for the best from him. He started seasons good but couldn't finish them well, seemingly. And now Matt Kemp is back in L.A., which everyone thought was going to be a circus. and back to the Dodgers in a move to get them underneath their luxury tax concerns by pushing out when they needed to spend all their money, you know, by getting rid of Kazmir and some of their other bloated signings, including Brandon McCarthy. They got under the luxury tax, and everyone assumed that the Dodgers were gonna drop Matt Kemp completely and just let him float away into the abyss. But that's not what happened. And the reports are that he's done quite well in camp, and he's been good to be around, and that he's got some renewed energy. And now all of a sudden, the situations in the Dodgers land don't appear to be so clear. So unlike me, Darius, do you see a road to playing time for Matt Kemp?
Well, I really didn't, but it seems like spring has gone about as well as it could have done for him. Jock Peterson's out there hitting 170 or something. Matt Kemp's hitting really well. Nobody's actually come out and said anything, as far as I can tell, but the buzz around the beat reporters and guys like that actually seem to think that not only is he going to be on this team, he's going to be playing fairly regularly to start the season, and that, I don't think that means 7 days a week, but maybe four or five. So we'll see what happens. He's a guy that really, if you only look at his fantasy stats, he's been kind of good still the last few years. And if you look at anything else, he isn't. And I'm pretty sure the Dodgers are not an organization who are only looking at fantasy stats. So I don't realistically see how they can put him out there on that regular basis for a long period of time. He needs to be hitting so well to be worth it, given how bad his defense is out there. He's not even a good base runner anymore. So I just think the chances of him getting a significant amount of playing time as the season goes on is slim. So right now I view him as an annoyance who's getting in the way of guys like Peterson and Andrew Toles. And we'll see how things go. But I can't imagine that he's going to stick out there in the outfield. He needs to be on an AL team, DHing basically, because all he can do these days is hit. And even that is kind of sliding away from him. So, yeah, I think it's annoying for others' fantasy value. And I don't see Matt Kemp getting enough playing time ultimately to be that relevant this season.
Well, Matt Kemp managed to hit .276 last year. I mean, he did have a .318 BABIP. But he has had some pretty high BABIPs in the past as well. 21% strikeout rate, 6% walk rate, basically. But he did end up with 19 home runs in 115 games. So like Darius mentioned, he certainly does not appear to be completely worthless. I would say that there's also the chance that if Justin Turner is out for a long time, one of the moves that hasn't been mentioned is playing Chris Taylor some at second base, which frees up extra outfield at bats as well. And there certainly is not, while Toles seems to be a decent high minor league player, there doesn't really seem to be someone necessarily blocking him from playing at least that three or four times a week that Darius was speaking of. So, Matt Kemp was the first player that I sent out to the guys, and as you can imagine, this player list doesn't necessarily, it's more a list of guys to talk about situations, and then we'll talk about how these players are actually similar later in the show. Now, how about Phil Hughes, who we all remember, well, we probably don't all remember, but I remember as a Yankee farmhand even, and how excited everyone was about Phil Hughes and his future. And he had a couple of pretty good years in New York, and then when he signed to Minnesota, it's mostly gone bad. So did you do some research, since I believe Darius is the one who let me know that he wasn't even sure that Phil Hughes existed anymore. So did you do some research and try and figure out why I would want to be talking about Phil Hughes?
Well, the thing that I remember about Phil Hughes is that before Clayton Kershaw did it a year or two ago, he had the all-time strikeout to walk record. I think it was something like 11 strikeouts per walk back in 2014. And that was basically because he just walked nobody. I think he walked half a batter per nine innings or something along those lines. So that's one thing I think of when I think of Phil Hughes. And the other thing I think is, wow, Phil Hughes hasn't been very good since then and didn't really pitch at all last year. So I don't know why you want to talk about him other than that he seems like he is actually going to pitch this year. He's probably about as unexciting as it comes. He still doesn't walk anybody. He also doesn't strike anybody out. He's had thoracic outlet surgery. So that's rarely a good sign. We've seen what that's done to a number of pitchers over the years. You know, Matt Harvey being a recent example of guys who don't seem to be able to get all the way back from this. And Phil Hughes didn't have a lot to lose in the beginning. So he's still surprisingly young. I was surprised to see he is only 31. But I just don't know what there is here. And I'm interested to hear what you have to say about him.
Well, the thing, there was early camp buzz for sure that Phil Hughes was actually pitching quite well. And since he's still under contract, and since the Minnesota pitching staff is sort of a work in progress up in the air, he's had good starts and bad starts in the spring. His ERA looks a little ugly because it's 7.71, but we know that can be small sample size. But he's started four games, and he's got 8 strikeouts and almost 12 innings pitched. So he has sort of struck out some people this spring. I just think he's going to get an open chance at the 5th starter spot in Minnesota. They have 4 starters listed on Roster Resource, and one of them is not Phil Hughes. They have him listed as their long reliever. But my mind tells me that while paying him, still paying him money, they are probably going to give him a run as the 5th starter. And that is why I wanted to mention it. I also wanted to sort of speak a little bit about this Minnesota Twins staff, because there appears to be a pretty large opening at the end of the staff, but there also appears to be, you know, with the Irvin Santana injury, you know, I've heard people speak of maybe Kyle Gibson having some upside. No one really knows what to take from Jake Odorizzi and Lance Lynn. And so briefly, I want to get Darius's take on these Minnesota players in general.
Yeah, I kind of like what they've done with the bargain signings. I don't think Odorizzi's ever quite turned into what maybe we thought he was going to be in for fantasy a couple of years ago. Lance Lynn is very reliable, I would say. And again, not a super high upside guy, but I think he's exactly the kind of guy they need to count on with Santana going down for a little while. He's the wild card to me. If he can come back and pitch like he did last year, then I think this rotation actually looks pretty good with Berrios at the top and then Santana at the number 2. I think that's good enough with Odorizzi and Lynn as well in there to help them compete. I don't think any of these guys, bar Berrios, has got, you know, super high upside, but I think they're probably going to get a bunch of innings out of them. And that's more than you can say for a lot of rotations around baseball right now. I mean, you look at what the Angels are doing, you look at what the Rangers are doing. I see a lot of guys here who are going to struggle to get to 110, 120 innings. You're going to be lucky with a lot of these pitchers, I think. So I kind of like what the Twins have done. Maybe that's more of a real-life baseball thing or a very deep league thing, just in terms of accumulating those innings. But yeah, not like a super high upside group, right?
So the next player on our list is Martin Prado, who was, of course, a long-time Atlanta Brave. Then he went to the Arizona Diamondbacks, and recent years he's been with the Miami Marlins. And Martin Prado, early in this offseason, I saw him slated to be as the starting left fielder in early projections on Roster Resource. He, of course, has been hurt again this spring, which is something that has been a recurring theme. But I just want to mention that Martin Prado is capable, still, you know, capable of producing a decent average and throwing in some speed, and maybe he actually has some positional flexibility at some point this season in what has turned into be kind of a carnival spring training for the Marlins. And the other thing I really want Darius to point on at with Martin Prado is that Lewis Brinson was announced that he's going to make the opening day roster and has a shot to lead off for them. So going along with this land of opportunity theme, I think this Lewis Brinson news is equally right in there.
Yeah, I mean, why not at this point? I think Brinson has done what he needs to do in the minors, and the Marlins are in a position where they're not going to contend, so they might as well let him play every day. But for that matter, yeah, I think Prado is probably going to get a ton of playing time if he's healthy as well. You don't see a huge amount of talent on this roster. I know some people are in on Brian Anderson, but I think Prado has the flexibility to move around and fill in at various spots. And I wondered if he can get healthy, if you could maybe see like the Joe Mauer type season. You're not going to get the power from him, but he has hit 300 on several occasions in the past. He does get good runs in RBI totals. Now Prado doesn't walk like Mauer does, but still I think he's that maybe the kind of guy that if everything breaks right for him and with the playing time, you could see that kind of sneaky season where people maybe even just leave him out on the waiver wire because there's like, oh, Martin Prado, who wants him? But actually, a guy playing every day who knows how to hit probably end up in the middle of this lineup based on how it looks right now. And you could get those counting stats out of him that at the end of the season, you go, oh, Martin Prado got 80 runs and 80 RBI. That was actually a pretty nice pickup for me. So I could see something like that. The upside in terms of power and speed is obviously significantly capped. So he's kind of a deep league guy, and just keep an eye on his health. And if he's playing every day, then I think he'll be dependable, assuming he hasn't just completely fallen off the cliff. But again, probably like the Twins rotation, not super exciting, just useful.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to run into the cliche of professional at-bats here. You're going to get professional at-bats from Martin Prado, and that's not exactly something that, you know, that you hang your hat on in fantasy circles. But if you get in trouble, it's something that can definitely matter. And perhaps if he ends up with outfield and third base eligibility, because they seem to be attempting to make Brian Anderson into their starting third baseman, then all of a sudden maybe he becomes a little more interesting in daily lineup changes kind of leagues as well. The next player that I want to talk about is Tyson Ross. Now, Tyson Ross is a player that was sort of rising up people's draft boards a few years ago, and he had killer strikeout rates and what have you. And the biggest problem that Tyson Ross had was his control. Well, Tyson Ross went through a really bad injury stretch, and now he has landed back in, he was at the Rangers last year, and now he's landed back in San Diego. So he's back in the National League, which helps his cause. I've heard some buzz around him that maybe a lot of you out there haven't heard. I guess that makes me a geek that listens to too many baseball outlets and is in too many baseball chat rooms. But I am wondering how you feel about both Tyson Ross and the potential of mining some decent value out of the San Diego pitchers this year.
Yeah, I mean, he was great. He was so great from 2013 to 15. Low ERA, never above 3.26. Strikeout rate, struck out more than a quarter of batters he faced in 2015. Almost up to 200 innings pitched those second couple of years as well. So this was all kind of looking really good for Ross, kind of going forward and maybe even developing into more. And then obviously the injuries hit. It's been a mess the last couple of seasons. Again, thoracic outlet guy. I was starting to wonder if this was your theme, but obviously Matt Kemp and Martin Prado haven't had thoracic outlet surgery as well, to my knowledge, but that would be quite a niche one. So he was a total mess last season. Couldn't get anything right. Couldn't get the ball over the plate. He walked nearly 7 batters per 9. The velocity was down. So that's all very concerning. Now, he seems to be healthy enough this spring that the Padres want to get him in the rotation. He's had some nice starts. He had a good 4-inning outing against the Dodgers the other day. So if he's there and he's healthy, he's not going to cost you anything at all. It's obviously a nice park. He's shown the potential to throw a ton of innings and get strikeouts. And I think given the state of pitching, that's probably something that you should take a shot on, even if he is going to maybe walk a few too many guys. It could all go horribly wrong and turn out like last season, and he'll have a 7 ERA again. But at the cost, I don't think he's even being drafted in most leagues. So maybe that will change over the next few days. Now it seems like he's locked down a rotation spot, but I would take a shot just because we've seen it from him before, and maybe we'll see it again.
Well, I do think the move back to the National League helps him. He does play in a lot of big parks in the NL West, but I think people often forget that those NL West pitchers also have road starts in Arizona, which maybe will get humidorized, which is not a word until now. And starts in Colorado are ones you obviously want to avoid. San Diego is a decent pitcher's park, and we know that L.A. and San Francisco are both very good pitcher's parks, so there is that. His spring training line is he's got a 3 ERA. He's got four starts in. He's got 11 strikeouts and 15 innings pitched, but I think most importantly for him is he's a 1.07 whip guy because I literally dropped him a few years ago because his whip was running so poorly at the time that I thought he was abusing me in one category, and I was hoping for more. We went through a parade of really deep drafts, and I know Darius was in on that parade, at least in the head-to-head league. But in really deep drafts, you see the starting pitching table just absolutely fall off at some point, where you're literally might as well be throwing darts at the dartboard and praying. And it's sometime after Jason Vargas is sort of, who is not anyone that I know of has ever been excited about having Jason Vargas, despite the fact I think he won 17 games last year, Vargas did. But regardless of all that, the biggest point here is that I think you should probably keep an eye on Tyson Ross and see how this goes because, the Ross brothers, Joe and Tyson, seem to be completely lost in the fantasy circles right now for the most part. And they're guys that at some point are going to reappear. And that appears to be what Tyson Ross has done. He's certainly going to get starts for the Padres, who are sort of Danilson Lamet and, some retreads and waiting for some help from the minors, the Robbie Erlin group, etc. So we are hopeful, or I am hopeful, that Tyson Ross helps deepen the starting pitching ranks that we see having diminished so significantly. Now, the next person that we're going to cover is Nate Ross. Is Nate Jones. We'll leave Nate Ross out of it since I don't know who that is. Anyway, I do want to recap so people can try and figure out the link I'm trying to make here. We've covered Matt Kemp and Phil Hughes and Martin Prado and Tyson Ross. And your next password, to quote an old game show, since we're trying to do a game show here, the next password is Nate Jones, who is another guy who missed basically the entire season last year. But Nate Jones, being that he pitches in the town of Chicago, and Darius always has his ear to the ground. He's basically, Chicago is his second home now, since he's done so much work for BP Wrigleyville. I want to know what Darius's thoughts are on Nate Jones for this coming season and what his role is going to be.
Yeah, of all these guys, I think I'm most confident that Jones is actually going to return fantasy value this year, and that still comes with a big health caveat because he barely pitched last season. I think he had the nerve repositioning surgery the same as Michael Fulmer did, and that kept him out almost the entire year last year. So I think if Jones is healthy, you can expect a ton of strikeouts. He was really good in 2016, almost 30% strikeout rate, just 5.5% walk rate. Guy can throw a high 90s. He's got a great slider. And I think that closer role is very up for grabs. Joaquin Soria did have a nice year last year, but Jones has kind of staked his claim in camp, and they haven't committed to anything in Chicago yet. So I think there's every possibility he gets that closer role. If not straight away, then certainly down the road. And I think even without it, he could be one of those guys you take or maybe even pick up off the free agent wire in shallower leagues, who can give you those great ratios. If you're in a holds league, then that's absolutely great as well, because I think he's going to provide a ton of holds. He's definitely going to have a high leverage spot in that bullpen if he's healthy. So, yeah, I really like Jones. I think he can give you strikeouts, ratios, and potentially saves as well. And, I don't think he's costing that much relative to what some of these other closer speculation targets people are going after seem to be.
Yeah, we were in our head-to-head league, and I noticed that Darius picked Nate Jones up quite late. And so I did some research and I found some articles in Chicago claiming that Nate Jones is the clear-cut favorite for winning the closing role in Chicago for the White Sox. And the thing about the White Sox in general is they didn't really address their bullpen. They haven't really addressed it since they got rid of Robertson. And Juan Minaya is a guy who you look at his stats and you kind of scratch your head and you go, well, maybe he finished the year as a closer. But then you look at sort of player recaps and you look at all these various outlets claiming that Juan Minaya is kind of was lucky to establish himself as a major league bullpen guy, let alone for us to foresee that he's going to be a closer for any significant stretch of time. And also, you know, it's interesting because Soria is the guy that you see listed on places like Roster Resources and what have you as being the closer in Chicago. He's not been very good in recent years, and when he's had the opportunity to be a closer, it seems like he's mostly fallen back into that role of the seventh or the eighth inning guy. And he kind of reminds me of Joaquin Benoit in a way, that his relief career keeps extending out, which is great, and he seems to be in decent roles, which is great, but he doesn't appear to be somebody anymore that we're relying on for saves. So I also agree with the speculation of Nate Jones as the likely closer for the White Sox this year if he is pitching well. He's also deep enough into his arb years that a team that's rebuilding is not going to be wildly concerned about him upping his arbitration kind of numbers. So I think the job is Nate Jones's to lose, from what I've gathered. And he has had a nice spring, and the reports have been very good on him. And he was very dominant. He was my he was my backup closer speculation for last year in a number of different leagues going into the year. And then he had the shoulder problems, and now he appears to be back. So the next player that I want to touch on, and the last one on our list, is a tad bit different than the other players on our list, except for one thing. He sort of ties into a situation that there's a lot of speculation upon right now, and that would be exactly how good the Oakland Athletics offense is going to be this year. The cherry on the top signing late was Jonathan Lucroy, who, of course, we are just 1 year removed from believing that Jonathan Lucroy was either the third or the fourth elite catcher of the only three or four elite catchers in the game of baseball as far as hitting was concerned. And we have done some talking about Lucroy, especially since he's recently signed. But I'm quite curious as to Darius's take on Jonathan Lucroy, his move to Oakland, and this Oakland offense. I want to know if his interest is as piqued as it seems like there is numerous tweets out there every day talking about how this boom or bust offense could definitely boom.
Yeah, I'm on the side of boom, I think. I mean, I think there's a lot of variance with the A's, but I do like what they're doing over there. I think they've got a lot of nice pieces in that lineup, and some more on the way with Dustin Fowler and Franklin Brito, I think, could provide some value. And I'm a big Matt Chapman fan, so I think there's potential for them to surprise a few people, although it sounds like that's going to be less and less of a surprise as the off-season goes along. But Lucroy is somebody I'm not personally optimistic about. We've had this up-down last 4 years from him, and you've kind of got bargains when he's had the down seasons, and then you've drafted him off the up seasons and been absolutely killed. I mean, he crashed teams last year. That was just a dreadful season. And it wasn't that he didn't play. He had nearly 500 plate appearances, and you got six home runs and less than 50 runs in RBI. I mean, I know catcher is a bad position, but that was a really dreadful return on the draft investment. And it just all looked bad. He's not making hard contact. There's so many ground balls. The thing that really concerned me was the way he was getting pitches were just going after him in the zone. He had nearly 54% of pitches in the zone. That's kind of like Ben Revere territory. This is how you pitch somebody who you're not scared about. And pitchers were not scared of Jonathan Lucroy's power at all. So the contact rate was still good. He's still capable of putting the bat on the ball, and he hit over 300 when he got to Coors, but still with no power. Now, catcher is a terrible position. And I think with that in mind, even if Lucroy can go out and hit 280 and play most of the season, that's going to be valuable. But Lucroy returning to sort of 20-plus homer guy, I just don't see it unless he makes a significant change. And maybe there's an injury we didn't know about. People have speculated about his framing decline and how he seems to be having trouble crouching. Maybe his knees are shot, or maybe he'll be feeling better this season and he can start putting the ball in the air again. But everything I saw last year was bad, and it never really got any better on that front. So I think he's limited as the Lucroy we saw last season, that he wasn't like a guy getting unlucky. He was just a bad power hitter. And if he's not going to hit for power, then there's only so much you can get out of him.
Well, I think the one thing about Jonathan Lucroy is that you can spin these things a lot of different ways with Lucroy. You could decide that last year was really his walk year, and that he was pressing an awful lot. You could spin it that way, although he's long enough in the tooth that you would think that he wouldn't be affected to that extreme, especially going to Colorado. Or you can look at Lucroy and you can say, well, you know, he's only 2 years removed and he's really got a batting average floor that is quite good for a catcher. Like, it's unlikely that he's going to bat worse than he did last year when his batting average was in the 260s. And at the end of drafts, especially two catcher drafts, you're drafting guys like James McCann, who you're praying for 240 from. So there's, there's that variance within it. There's also the idea or the concept that if you fully believe in the A's offense as boom, that some of that effect is going to really help him. That there would be a lot of opportunities against bad middle relief pitching if the A's are thumping people soundly. That people would get walked in front of him on a regular basis to help sort of put him in good situations, and that he would score a lot more runs than we first thought possible. I am not an athletics fan. Anyone who listens to this podcast knows that I'm not a big fan of their work. But I will say this, the team that they're putting on the field right now, you know, looks like the 1929 Yankees compared to the team they were putting on the field a couple years ago. There is at least upside with all of these, with almost all of these players. And it's hard for me to detach myself from Jonathan Lucroy. That was the Brewer. He was a really, really good teammate at all times. He was always a good hitter. His power went in and out. He was set to, I believe, what is still the all-time record for doubles by a catcher. And he's not ancient. Catchers don't always age very well, but he's an odd build for a catcher. You know, he's not this bulky, huge guy. He's not this Carlton Fisk at the end of his career kind of hulking player. He's pretty slight of build for a catcher. And so that, that led to the fact that he actually ran kind of good early in his career, and he threw in a couple stolen bases here and there. He's also very well known as a pitch framer, and he's got a really interesting staff to work with this year. And I've pointed out that he could maybe make the most grounds by signing this one-year incentive-laden deal by having that Oakland A's staff turn in a really good year on the mound, because people will automatically – I don't think automated strike zone is coming this year or next year. I really don't. Sometimes I think it should, but it's not going to. And so this pitch framing art that people talk of, if he bounces back somewhat offensively and all of a sudden you're getting good starts from Andrew Triggs and, you know, some of these less, especially now that Jarrell Cotton is out, you know, especially some of these less ballyhooed pitchers. If he's good for Sean Manaea, then I think you're going to see a rebuilding team that doesn't have a lot going on at catcher be a lot more interested in him next year. So, you know, I hate to throw it back at you again, but I'm going to. Do you think some of these angles that I'm taking are just overblowing things? Or do you think that that some of this could play into his overall performance and the overall results? I mean, I don't want to overpaint his upside, but I do think it's conceivable for him to be a top six catcher this year with a pretty minimal amount of bounce back. Is that too optimistic?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think if you look at especially catcher batting averages, Luke Roy could so significantly outproduce some of the other guys. I mean, Mike Zunino was pretty close to being a top five, if not already a top five catcher last year. There's a guy who strikes out an absolute ton. You know, that all over you can see guys who are going to struggle to hit 230, 240. So you can easily imagine Luke Roy out hitting them by 60, 70 points. That's going to be a huge amount of value that he's going to return there. So I don't think it's at all inconceivable that he could get there. And I think at the draft cost that he's been going at so far, then that would kind of be a nice little value. But yeah, it's just that I think if you're drafting him maybe a bit higher than that, expecting to get some of the power back, that's what I'm dubious about. But I definitely think that it's not going to be hard for him. And we know he has the talent to do that, to be a top 2-3 catcher. And even if you take the power away, I think the batting average is enough to carry him at least into the top 10.
Well, I certainly feel like Jonathan Lucroy has some upside on that team this year. You know, it's always nice to be in the American League versus the National League for the first five innings anyway these days, until the pitcher gets out of the way for late inning pinch hitters. Well, I put together kind of an odd list, and you know, part of it is definitely touching on players that you're not going to hear a lot about on other podcasts. So the list of players that I put together is Matt Kemp, Phil Hughes, Martin Prado, Tyson Ross, Nate Jones, and Jonathan Lucroy. Darius, would you like to gander a guess on exactly why I would put those players together and what they have in common?
Yeah, this was a difficult one. It certainly seemed like a super weird list when I saw it. So, I mean, the things that linked them to me were things that we've already touched on, really, that they're all going kind of late. I mean, Luke Roy's the closest to not being late, I guess, but he's still outside the top 200. I couldn't actually find Phil Hughes on the Fantasy Pros ADP list, so I guess nobody has drafted him, which is kind of funny because they have about 800 players on there. And the other thing was that they've all kind of had, I think, sort of role changes or at least look like they might have more playing time than we expected from recent news, whether it's being signed or just good spring performance pushing them up, whatever it might be. I think they have gained value from things that have happened in the last few weeks. So those were kind of the two things that leapt out to me, but I couldn't find anything more obvious than that linked them all.
Well, no, I think you're touching at some of what I'm getting at here. I think maybe Jonathan Lucroy is the one that's a less glaring example of what I was sort of going for. And I'm not one to not acknowledge sort of when I pick up lingo or pick up stuff from other podcasts. And for years, and I do miss the quality of this podcast because I don't like it nearly as much anymore, but for years the Fantasy Focus guys used to talk about something that they called as a player being a fantasy zombie. Being someone who was back from the dead, someone that we had written off in our minds nearly permanently, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, they come back and they are significantly changing the outcomes of weekly head-to-head leagues or changing stat categories in ways that we never even thought going into the season. So I went through the exercise of trying to find guys that could at least fill most of those things that they talked about as being a fantasy zombie. So as I challenge Darius to come up with some players like that off the top of his head. I wonder if he would like to venture a guess at exactly which one of these players he thinks is going to come back in the most exciting way. And I'm not going to let him cheat and take Jonathan Lucroy, since we know his role is in stone. So you think Nate Jones is the player that's most likely to significantly contribute, or maybe just rate the players in your mind that you know out loud for us that you think we should be keeping an eye on as the season starts here.
Yeah, I think Jones is the one that I would say I feel most confident in significant contributions from. I guess I would probably say that I feel like Prado is maybe the safest if you're just looking for anything. Kemp obviously has more upside than Prado does with the bat, but I just don't see the playing time for him. And then I guess if you were looking for somebody who you think is just going to come out and be like an absolute blow everybody away, you know, go and be a top 20 at his position or something, I suppose it's Ross. That would really surprise me, but we have seen him do something similar to that in the past, and it's really hard to believe given how much time he's missed. But if he's in the rotation and he's got the slider back and some of the velocities come back, and he's not walking too many guys, I could see him going out and being like the kind of starter that we're finding it difficult to locate at that point in the draft, as you said, that we just, those guys aren't out there anymore. And he could technically, I think, pitch a bunch of innings and get you a bunch of wins or quality starts and strike out over a batter per inning and end up returning a lot of value for his minuscule draft costs. So, I guess I would say Ross for upside, but Jones would be my pick if you're just looking for who's going to offer the most this season. I think I'm pretty sure it's going to be him.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, there's some lesser forms of this that I want to point to. And this is kind of mean for me to do, but we have a little extra time today because our man J.R. Fenton could not be with us, but John Russell will be with us in the coming weeks. So I just want to point out that Jason Kipnis is a guy that we've spoken about on a regular basis that I think people had written off going into the draft season. I think to a far lesser form of that, I feel within drafts that the second baseman from the Anaheim Angels now, Ian Kinsler, has been largely written off as a fantasy player due to his age and due to his relatively mild season, although it was hard to imagine he had a lot of incentive to play well last year in Detroit as everything was crumbling around them. And how about Victor Martinez, who's having a really good spring? Last year we heard news of him possibly having been injured to such an extent that he wasn't coming back. And now it looks like he's going to be the cleanup hitter on a major league team. So, and I've seen him go undrafted in multiple drafts. Why don't you comment on any of those guys that struck you first, and then after that, see what your brain racks as far as other potential fantasy zombies.
Yeah, I really like Kinsler. I mean, I think he's going to be hitting ahead of Mike Trout. So I don't know if you need to say much more than that. The guy can get on base. He's always had a pretty decent eye. And I think that's basically the best spot to be in baseball. So, I think he's going to return plenty of value in Los Angeles. And we've seen that they've actually lowered a fence there as well. So we might even expect a few more home runs than we were initially thinking of from Kinsler. So I think he would be the guy there that I would focus on as somebody who could really return significant value and score a ton of runs in that lineup. Somebody who jumps out to me from people we talked about last week is Hanley. He's going very late outside the top 300, and he has the potential. It was only 2016 that he had a great fantasy year. I think we could easily see him come back and hit 30 home runs and drive in a ton of guys in Boston's lineup if he's healthy. The late flyer that I want to mention, because he's my favourite player ever, is Tim Lincecum. I don't know what's going to happen with Lincecum. He's probably not going to start the season with the Rangers because he's got a late start and he's gone through some things with his brother dying as well. But that bullpen is wide open to me. I could see several different guys getting saves. Lincecum has been good in relief in the past if he is actually throwing 92, 93 at least. With that changeup working, I could see him at the very least returning you some nice strikeouts and ratios. And I think the bullpen is open enough that I would not be absolutely shocked if he ended up getting saves this year. So if you're really looking for a zombie who didn't even pitch last year, then I'm going to say Tim Lincecum.
Well, I think that is a deep zombie scape, but you've mentioned it well. In my drafts, when I hear somebody heavily invested in Alex Claudio, I just I have a hard time understanding that. You know, he just does not have the profile at all of a closer, and it's not, you know, there are guys who succeed for long stretches without a closer profile. You know, Brad Ziegler is a guy who managed to get 20 saves, or seemingly 15 to 20 saves at least, for years on end without being a guy that you would ever think would be a closer. But it seems like this is a far more open competition in Texas, and it seems like, you know, that it was their idea to come out and mention that they were going to use him in the bullpen and potentially as a closer. So I think that is a very worthwhile thing to be monitoring closely as the season goes on. We'll know a lot more on some of these closer situations once the season starts. I certainly think Dominic Leon is a guy that I'm heavily invested in a couple leagues, including the TGFBI league that I'm in, where all the buzz is that he's pitching great, he's coming off a great year, and that hopefully he gets a shot. But Gregerson is pitching again now, and there's this talk of Tyler Lyons, and you wonder if they care about the arbitration numbers they might build with Leon, or if they're going to focus on how much they can compete this year. Anything surrounding Mike Matheny seems to be something of a gamble extraordinaire. We're also hearing every buzz you can imagine that the closer situation in Arizona is wide open. So all of a sudden, Brad Boxberger maybe is a guy that could have fallen in our fantasy zombie discussion. Another guy who had a bad year that I'm going to keep an eye on and see how it goes, because he really came back strong at the end of last year, is the backup closer in Colorado. So before I tell you, who do you think the backup closer is in Colorado, Darius?
I mean, I would say Adam Ottavino, if you ask me to guess.
Well, they seem to be pretty reluctant to give him the job in recent years. I mean, I know he sort of finished a season a couple years ago with it. But my guess as to who the backup closer would be in Colorado if he starts out pitching the way that he pitched at the end of last season is Jake McGee, who I think would qualify for certain as a fantasy zombie. I've seen Brian Shaw, who I believe went directly from Cleveland to Colorado, if I have his career path correct. I've seen Brian Shaw listed as the main setup man, so some people just fall into the main setup man as the backup closer, even though we know that doesn't really happen. And this weekend I saw Brad Boxberger drafted as if he was the closer in Arizona. I know Archie Bradley has had a bad season. Is your gamble on their Japanese import, or is your gamble on Boxberger or Bradley in Arizona?
Yeah, I've got a couple of shares of Boxberger. My inclination is that it's going to be him if they don't give it to Bradley. I don't know. Hirano is not like a mega strikeout guy, and maybe he'll be like a Ziegler or a Claudio. But by the way, I think Alex Claudio is really good, but I think they might prefer to use him in other roles, put out fires elsewhere. He can get ground balls. I think for his skill set, he's actually a terrific pitcher for a guy who doesn't even throw 90, but he's got mid to low 70s change up, and he really throws hitters off balance. So I think he's a really good pitcher. But yeah, I question whether they will lock him into that role, because I think Jeff Bannister might prefer to move him around. But I think Boxberger seems to me like he's a guy who's had some closing experience. He can strike a bunch of guys out, and I think they have dropped hints about liking Bradley as that multi-inning option that maybe they won't necessarily use as closer. And sometimes I do wonder if we're going to see more teams actually properly move away from the role. We saw lower save numbers last season than I think we have for a while. We saw like the Reds getting creative with Raisel Iglesias, using him for a couple of innings and not necessarily always in the closer role. I think they even brought him in the fourth, fifth sometimes when starts went bad. So I do question, we've been hearing this for ages and you always hear teams say, oh, we're going to go with it by committee and then one guy gets the job. But I wonder, as more progressive managers get hired and we have more progressive front offices, whether we start seeing guys get 25, 30 saves a year as the primary closer instead of 35, 40, 50, because teams are actually realising that they want to use their best pitchers in the best spots, and the best way to do that is not necessarily to have a guy locked to the ninth inning.
Well, on that front, and since we wandered onto the conversation, I just want to mention the Hector Neris situation in Philadelphia. Have you heard a lot about that, Darius? Gabe Kapler is their new manager, and he is quite the progressive thinker. The anti-Matheny is what Matt Thompson would like to call it. And being the progressive thinker that he is, he's floated the idea to Hector Neris that Neris should be used in the highest leverage situations. Therefore, and supposedly, Hector Neris has completely embraced not only his new manager, but this philosophy. I had a lot of early shares of Hector Neris and found myself being a little concerned because our game does not accurately portray when a pitcher comes in crucial situations earlier in the game. Our value generally comes from saves. Now, on that front, I have a guy who is not really a fantasy zombie, a guy that would be a fantasy breakout. I believe that Tommy Hunter would be the guy who is coming off a really excellent relief season. He would be the guy that would likely benefit if Neris was regularly pitching in the seventh or the eighth inning. Now, they do have other options in that bullpen, and I don't mean to say that I think Tommy Hunter would get all of the saves that Neris doesn't get. But as a guy who's going really, 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 if he's going at all late, Tommy Hunter is a guy who has some value as a middle reliever if he pitches like he did last year and could stumble onto saves. Had you run into that story about the Phillies bullpen before?
I hadn't read that particular one. I have read a lot of stories about Gabe Kapler. I'm really looking forward to this season actually and following what he does, because it seems like it's going to be a wacky one over there in Philadelphia. But it doesn't surprise me at all that he's willing to get creative. And I think this is the kind of bullpen that you can try it with, because Neris is not a super established closer. You've not got the veteran guy. You've not got the Jonathan Papelbon or someone out there who's just going to be like, what are you doing? I hate this. Like Cole Hamels over there in Texas saying, I'm not having this six-man rotation. You haven't got that guy over there, I don't think. And so I think it might be a good group to try it with, get some buy-in from the players. And if it starts to work, if you've got Neris coming in the seventh and putting out a fire, I think you'll start to see the players buy in more and more and get less locked into the closer role. So, I could see that happening for sure. And I like the Hunter pick. He was really good last year. So I could definitely see him having a ton of value. And even if he isn't getting a ton of saves, again, if you're in a holds league or if you're just looking to pad the ratios, he had some great numbers last year.
So, and part of this exercise today that I want to get at is that every year we do sort of run into this fantasy zombie that seemingly comes out of nowhere. Well, it's going to be almost impossible to predict. It's just one thing that Justin Mason likes to pick on me about my show topics, is that I come up with these ways that supposedly we could try and find some value, but how the heck are we going to predict how it happens? But at the same time, I think these guys who are building momentum towards being able to, that you need two things, in my opinion. You need some momentum, some impetus that these organizations think that these players could come back and do some solid things. And look at Tyson Ross's spring. I mean, he's a guy that, he was not certain to make the rotation going into the year, and now we know he's in the rotation. Then, on top of that, the other thing you need is you need a team that will give you opportunity. Okay? Right now, there's no real opportunity like anywhere in the Yankees lineup. Okay? Like, they're platooning outfielders that should start for almost any other team. So there's no opportunity there. But you look at some of these opportunities that I tried to point out. The Minnesota Twins, starters. You know, that is, we know that with Irvin Santana down especially, and the other variables in those pitchers, that there's a significant chance there that someone's going to come out of nowhere. You take, add the Turner injury into what is sort of an outfield that's never been fully embraced by the Dodgers. You know, you mentioned Jock Peterson's struggles. We thought he was going to be an established regular by now. Andrew Toles had the year-long injury. You know, Puig, you never know. We want to think that he's matured and that his steps off the deep end are over, but we don't really know. So that's an interesting situation. Nate Jones and the White Sox closer job is wide open, and there was obviously an opening that was created by their returning catcher's personal issues, and now all of a sudden Jonathan Lucroy is in a good situation. So I think you do get something out of looking for these situations. And just so I do not have to go back and tell you that I almost brought this guy up, a guy who's had a very good spring in a situation that's relatively wide open at the back end of the Brewers rotation is Wade Miley. And Wade Miley is a guy that I wouldn't want to call a fantasy zombie because I'm not really sure he's ever been all that good. I will close this off by asking Darius how many good starts he would have to see from Wade Miley in a row before he would even raise his eyebrow and consider him an option. But I do think Wade Miley, the buzz is that he's going to get a crack at an end of the rotation spot for the Brewers. And after that, Darius can give us what he's working on and such, and we can get out of here. What do you think about Wade Miley as the deepest end game flyer?
Well, I actually hear quite a lot about Wade Miley because Tom Pringle of Batflips and Nerds is obsessed with the guy. So he's constantly bringing up Wade Miley and how he's going to make the Brewers rotation. So I'm probably in one of the few places where I'm hearing about Wade Miley's rotation chances on a near constant basis. But actually, yeah, I don't think I would need to see too much. I remember reading something, I think it was last year, it was probably from Jeff Sullivan, about how similar he is to Dallas Keuchel in a lot of ways, but he hasn't quite figured out that level of command where he can live at just at the bottom of the zone and get hitters guessing and make them chase bad pitches or make them leave pitches that just catch the bottom edge. But he's kind of in that area, and he did have a good season. I think it was either his rookie year or maybe his sophomore year with Arizona. He was actually a pretty productive pitcher. He could easily just blow right up in your face, and that would not surprise me either. But I think if I come out and I see him spotting his pitch as well, and the control numbers look good, and yeah, I could certainly see myself taking a shot. And as you say, I think it's a really good point. Just these guys who get the opportunity, there's value in that. What teams do, you know, they can say all the things they like in spring training, but let's see what the actions actually say. Who do they actually take on the roster going into the season, especially these guys like Miley, who they have no compulsion to put on the roster. If they don't think he's any good, then they won't go for it. So they need to see something there in the next week, you know, that they've got to make these decisions. And those guys who get picked, I think, just for the chance that it works out, this is the time now to go and strike if you can pick guys up, or if you're in a late draft and you're just looking for a flyer. Just find that guy who's shown something before and who has the opportunity and see what you get. And if it doesn't work out, you can drop him in two or three starts when he gets bombed.
Yeah, I think that's true. Why don't you, while I look up his spring training stats, why don't you tell us what you're working on now, buddy, and what your Twitter handle is and where we can look for your work, all of that stuff.
So you can find me on Twitter at DariusA64. You can find all my fantasy stuff over at Baseball Prospectus. We've got the model portfolio stuff coming up over the next few days there, where basically everybody kind of designs their ideal draft around Mike Giannella's auction values. So it's basically building, if the roster could turn out exactly as you wanted it, what kind of team would you draft? So that'll be a fun one. I'll be doing mine for Monday next week. You can also find me over at Banished to the Pen, where we've been going through the season previews. A lot of great stuff from a lot of great writers. We've got different writers for every team. So we've got all kinds of really fun angles over there. And you can also find me at Batflips and Nerds, which is getting a lot of hype right now because the sort of announcement has just come out that they're actually going to do games in London, and the Red Sox and Yankees are going to be the teams that are at those games. So kind of waiting for official confirmation from that. But that kind of got leaked a couple of days ago. So if you're interested in British baseball and how things are going to pan out in London and what we think of it, then I'm literally about to record a podcast now. So go and add Batflips and Nerds to your podcast app and check that one out as well.
Yeah, Darius does some great work for us, to say the least, and he's always wonderful to work with, which I certainly appreciate. Wade Miley's spring stats, 5.06 ERA. Kind of curious, though, he's got 18 strikeouts and 16 innings pitched. His whip is 1.5. Again, it's so hard to know exactly what's going to happen with spring training stats. But I also would like to point out that being a left-handed pitcher in Miller Park sort of has its advantages because the porch in right field is especially friendly. So perhaps we see some rebirth from some guys like Wade Miley. And I just wanted to get us focusing on some people that might go a little bit better than we would have ever imagined going into spring training. So I hope I did that for you today. I am Chuck Anderson. I can be reached at Just Chucking It on Twitter, and I always love to interact with fans thereof. So feel free to do that, and I'm starting to put out some weekly content here very soon for the upcoming Major League season that will appear on friendswithfantasybenefits.com. Thanks so much for the listen. Thanks if you played along with us. I hope you're enjoying this concept. Darius, you a fan of the concept in general?
Yeah, I'm enjoying it. It's fun, and I think it gives us the opportunity to maybe talk about a few players who, you know, they're not trendy. They're not going to get talked about. Everybody's on Ronald Acuna, and not many people are talking about Martin Prado. So I think it's really helpful, because if you're in a deep league, you still have to draft these guys, and we don't spend a lot of time talking about them.
Yeah, so we're definitely trying to help you guys out in as many ways possible. So feel free to support us every way you can, including giving us a review on iTunes or on your various podcatcher. Thanks so much. This was a Friends with Fantasy Benefits pop quiz podcast. I'm lining up some special guests for future weeks, and I also have we also have J.R. Fenton joining us again next week, which we very much look forward to. So until we get your listen again, thank you so much, and we will go from there.